And welcome back to Fully Equipped. This is Tim Breon from TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall from golf.com. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Listen, before we get started today, I got to clarify something. My wife listened to the podcast here recently, and she asked me, she said, is the guy that you do the podcast with, is he really a professor? and I've got to come clean here. It is merely a nickname. At least I don't think that you're a professor, but you're still the smartest guy that I know, Tim. So that's why you get the professor designation.
I think, you know, all of the knowledge that I've been able to gain in the golf industry regarding equipment, it just means that I've been doing this a long time and made a lot of mistakes. So I'm very fortunate to have been in the positions I've been in, instructionally, you know, being around a lot of really smart people and always trying to make sure that I'm in a room where there's somebody else smarter than me in there. So just try to gather up as much as I can along the way and absorb it like a sponge and be able to apply it and help people play the game. That's I think, what all of us that are involved in this, that's what our objective is make the game more fun and help people enjoy it to the level and extent that we all do. So what's teed up for this week?
But the professor designation is a term of endearment. I just want to throw that out there.
it's interesting because I've actually now started to have that moniker with some of my coworkers and associates. They started to say it tongue in cheek. I may have to get a business card here soon. So,
oh man, here we go.
Well, so what's going on this week, Jonathan? You know, obviously big week, tour championship, kind of the end of the official season. So this is usually lots of activity in the equipment world out on tour. What are we going to get into this week?
Yep. So let's get into discussing Rory switching golf balls. You know, this isn't something that he did recently. It was done back towards the early part of the year, but with his win at the Tour Championships, I think it's worth revisiting this switch and how it could benefit the recreational golfer. News flash. Victor Hovland has put his fourth set of irons in play, Tim. I know you're surprised. We got to dig into that. And you know, now that the Tour Championship is done and we kind of go into the wraparound season, you know, this is a time that's kind of changed the way that players, at least some of them, have started to test. So let's get into that a bit. A golf ball that can make a putt from anywhere on the green. It's not a dream.
Sign me
it's
up.
Actually a reality. We got to get into that. And then I got a couple of really good pod questions for this week. So it should be a great episode.
Outstanding. So let's get into the golf ball question with Rory, the $15 million decision. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there, Jonathan.
Yeah. So Rory, at the beginning of the year, actually, let's just go all the way back to last year's PGA Championship. So while playing with Tiger Woods and Justin Thomas during the 2018 PGA, Rory told me when I was in Austin this year for the match play that he started to notice that both players were hitting controlled flighted wedge shots. And it started to kind of get him thinking, you know, I like hitting these really high wedge shots into the greens. They definitely are always going to hold, but how can I gain a bit more control and consistency with my wedges? So one of the things that Rory tested was a new golf ball. And he went from TaylorMade's TP5X, which is the lower spinning ball of the two, to the TP5. And, you know, Tim, I think this is a great opportunity to kind of bring this back to the recreational golfer. You know, for the most part, I feel like we've kind of gotten to a time in the industry right now where everyone's touting low spin, low launch. But, you know, that doesn't work for everybody. You know, spin can be your friend. And I think Rory's a perfect example of a guy who's insanely long, but can actually benefit from spin. And in this golf ball that he's using, you know, this is an opportunity for recreational golfers out there to potentially go out and test the ball with a bit more spin, because spin can actually help you and it can help with your consistency.
It sure can. And as you mentioned, there's been this thing in equipment recently where a lot of folks are focused on lower spinning products. Lower spinning products are going to help you hit it further as long as you have the club head speed and ball speed to be able to support it. It's also going to mean that when the ball is slicing or hooking, it's not going to slice or hook as much. But all of this comes with a huge caveat, and what I think a lot of amateur golfers may not understand is there's a preferred spin window, and that's based upon the speed of the golf ball. That spin window actually shifts up a little bit and goes higher the slower the golf ball takes off from the face of the club. So when you're looking at drivers, preferred spin window for, you know, a tour player is going to be right around that 2000 mark, maybe a shade under or a shade over. When you get into slower golf ball speeds coming off the face, you get into, you know, your higher handicap players, your slower club head speed players, that spin window actually shifts upwards a little bit. Reason being that that extra spin is actually helping keep the ball in the air, preventing the ball from falling out of the sky. The thing to take away from all of this, I think, is A, what you mentioned regarding Rory's wedges. Everybody, when they tested the 5X golf ball when it first came out, was amazed at what it did for their long game, their driver. You know, a player like Rory that generates so much club head speed, they're going to generate a lot of spin as well. And so when you're talking about a driver in the long game, that reduced spin is going to help them hit the ball a lot farther. And it's going to mean that the wind has less bearing over what the ball does. I don't know if you remember when they first introduced 5X, but all the guys were raving about the control that they got in windy conditions that they just didn't get out of other golf balls. That's due to the low spin properties of the product. I will say this about the 5X product. It's incredibly low spinning. Of all of the products that are available out these days, I don't know of very many golf balls that even come close when it comes to, you know, knocking spin off the ball. But how does that play into your short game? We mentioned this in a previous pod that we did, Jonathan, whereby ball selection really should be more about what's going on with the wedges in the short game, because that's where you score. That's where, you know, you're hitting your putter more often than any other club in the set. And, you know, when you look at your wedges, you're using your wedges with full swings or three-quarter swings on a few par fives, maybe a few par fours. And then you're obviously using your wedges every time you miss a green. So you're probably using your wedges and putter more than any other club in the bag. And so therefore, you should consider what's going on with the performance of your ball with those clubs specifically. You know, what you mentioned earlier about amateur golfers maybe not understanding what they should be using as far as a golf ball. Go to a practice green, test a few different balls, see what happens on those short chips or on shorter pitches. Go back to 60, 70 yards on those half wedge shots, hit a few out of the rough, see what happens. Narrow the selection process down to two or three different options that seem to be performing well with your wedge shots, and then bring it back and see what it does with the driver. Get on a launch monitor, compare them on a launch monitor, and see what the spin rates are on drivers and six irons. I think, you know, the mid-iron spin control characteristics a lot of times are the determinant factor once you've narrowed it down to a couple. But you should always make your initial selection for golf ball based off the short game and the wedge play. Obviously, this worked out very well for Rory. One of the things that I would say that has been, I don't know about a weakness, because when Rory is playing well, I don't know of anybody other than, you know, Tiger that has the ability to do things with the golf ball that he does. I would say that the one weakness.
Not even Brooks Koepka?
Yeah, well.
Not even BK? Not even BK?
Amazing things. He can do some pretty amazing things with the golf ball, too. But, you know, with the speed that Rory goes at and the way he maneuvers the ball, the one weakness I would say in his game may have been those mid-length wedge shots. You know, I've seen him hit a few of those shots much farther from the hole than he should for a player of his caliber. So, hearing that this ball has helped with that isn't a surprise. He's coming off of, I kind of think it flew under the radar how well his season went this year. Don't you, Jonathan? I mean, it's probably one of his best years he's ever put together. He didn't get a major necessarily, but you know, his finishes this year have been outstanding.
Oh yeah, no, and statistically, if you look at Rory's numbers this year, you know, going back to the golf ball here, he's actually seen some real tangible improvements. If you go down to strokes gained approach the green, he was 12th this year on tour. Strokes gained around the green, he was 19th. You know, these are areas of Rory's game that he's always typically struggled with. It, you know, strokes gained off the tee with the driver in his hand, he's lethal. But it's been the other areas that have always kind of held him back. Obviously, the putter too. He was 24th this year on tour. So he's seeing some real improvement since he made that switch to the golf ball. And it's coming in the areas that you highlighted, short game, you know, an area where I think more people, when they're testing golf balls, they need to spend more time working their way around the green, on the putting green, seeing how that ball feels, seeing how it reacts, instead of spending so much time just looking at ball speed and launch numbers with a driver.
Yeah, absolutely. And one last little piece on the golf ball selection. I know that we mentioned this in a previous pod as well. some of the really, really super elite players are actually looking for high spinning balls. I know you've spent some time with Tiger in the past, and the golf ball that he played was hardly a super low spin ball. It was actually a very high spin ball. And the mindset there is, I want my golf ball to give me the broadest catalog of shots available. If I want to hook it, I want to be able to hook it 80 yards. I want to be able to stop it on a green with a 3-wood. I want to be able to pull off shots that nobody else can pull off. And then I'll use my mechanics and my skill to take spin off when I need to take spin off. It's a very different mindset from, I think, most of the players that are playing on tour, and definitely from amateurs.
100%. I totally agree with you there. And, you know, Tiger with that Bridgestone Tour BXS, you know, he's told me multiple times in the past that he wants spin. Spin is his friend. And you look at all of his, you look at all the lofts on his irons. I mean, he is very old school when it comes to the lofts, and he loves to work the ball both ways. And as you mentioned, the only real way to start working that golf ball both directions is to get spin, especially when it comes to those short irons. In mid irons, you need spin to be able to keep the ball in the air. So, you know, if it's working for Tiger and how it's working for Rory, it's certainly something that's worth kind of digging in to for the recreational golfer. All right, let's get into this is becoming my favorite weekly topic, Tim. I love talking about Victor Hovland's equipment. He's always got something new in the bag. More recently,
we need to get him on the pod, Jonathan. We need to get Victor on the pod.
Oh man,
sometime.
I know. I've got to make this happen. We've got to get Victor on the podcast. He fits our listenership to a T. I would dare say he's a gearhead in every sense of the word. But you know, as we've talked about here in recent podcasts, pretty much every podcast for the last three or four, Victor Hovland is, newsflash, he changed irons. And it just so happens to coincide with him earning his PGA Tour card, which I think is pretty incredible. But for the fourth time in seven starts, Victor used a different iron combination. So he started his professional career off with Ping's I-210 and I-blades. He had the 4-6 in the I-210s. He had the 7-3 pitching wedge in the I-blades. He's used the Blueprint, which is the more compact, actually the most compact iron that Ping has in his short irons. He's used I-blade at the top of the set. He even used a full set of I-blades more recently. And, you know, for a guy who's used four different sets of irons, you would think that he would be struggling with his ball striking. And I went in to go take a peek at his statistics. And, you know, Victor's stats don't count for the tour just yet. But he is almost a full stroke better than the field average in stroke scan approach to the green. And his statistical number right now would rank him third on tour, Tim, behind just Henrik Stenson and Justin Thomas. Wow. And still, the guy continues to test irons. So, you know, I'm sure people are probably asking, what is Victor Hovland looking for in a set of irons that he hasn't found yet? And I think, you know, just kind of going back and looking at what he has used, in my opinion, I think he's looking for ideal turf interaction. You know, he's used three different models, I-210, I-blade, Blueprint. All those have very different sole widths. You know, the I-210 is more of a player iron. I-blade is better player. Blueprint, I would even say, is like, you know, your scratch to pro player. It's a very, very small sole width. So, you know, I think he's just looking for something that works. Maybe that's why he's used a bunch of combo sets. I mean, Tim, what else can we say about this guy? I mean, he is fully equipped, dream guest, obviously, but he's certainly a guy that's certainly worth talking about with all the changes he's been making.
I just feel bad for his caddy. I mean, I'd be a basket case to keep up with all these different sets and setups and distances and yardages. And, you know, I feel bad for the caddy in this, but a couple things going on. I agree wholeheartedly with what you just stated as far as looking for turf interaction. Something that a lot of listeners may not realize, but the design, the geometry, the width, all of the shaping to the way the bottom of the golf club is designed, that's going to radically change the way that your club feels when it makes contact with the ball, but specifically the turf. And it's going to change the way it exits the turf, whether it tends to dig more or dig less. And that has a huge component over feel. Another big thing I think that is going on here is it's just him getting familiar with the Ping product line. Once again, as we've mentioned, he's new to the Ping staff. He's played TaylorMade, you know, for quite a while throughout his collegiate years. and making that transition into a completely new product line, I think he just wants to make sure that the setup that he has in the bag is the absolute best for him. One little side note to note here, you know, when you told me about this fourth equipment change, the first thing that came to my mind is, what are the loft packages on these irons? Because if, you know, one thing that a lot of listeners may not realize, but when you're talking about standard specs or standard loft, it's not just different from manufacturer to manufacturer, but it's different from product line to product line. When you look at a P790 from TaylorMade and compare that to the Tiger Woods iron, you're looking at, you know, 8 degrees of loft difference between them. That's two clubs different. So from one product line to the next, you're going to see different loft packages and different setups, not just from one club to the next, but the increments are also different. Some clubs go with a 5 degree loft differential in the scoring irons. Some go with a more traditional 4. Some clubs go with a 2 degree loft differential in the long iron. So it's different from one product line to the next, and that's all determined by the manufacturer through their testing process. And so one of the things that I did a little homework on here, when you mentioned that we've gone to a fourth equipment setup, is all of the lofts and the loft packages throughout these three different product lines that he's switching in and out are actually extremely similar. Whether you're
actually, Tim, I've got an answer for you. Nice. I spoke to Ping Tour Rep Ket Notes, and he said that Victor's lofts across the board, even when he's doing combo sets, are all very standard. So he's not making a lot of alterations to the loft, which, as you mentioned, would alter the way that the club's going through the turf. So everything's pretty standard for him.
Yep. And that's kind of what I suspected. There would be no way that he could go from one week to the next, going to iron setups that were radically different for loft packages. And it's not just as simple as, this product over here has lofts that are 2 degrees stronger or 3 degrees stronger. Let's just bend them and get them to the same loft. It's not that simple, because when you bend loft, you're also changing the bounce, and that's going to change turf interaction. When you take a degree of loft off of a club, when you're talking irons and wedges, you're negating bounce by the same amount, 1 degree. So if you're playing a 10 degree bounce sand wedge and you strengthen it 1 degree, you're basically turning it into a 9 degree bounce wedge. And then vice versa, if you're adding loft, then you're adding bounce. And this is something that's incredibly important, especially for really good players, you know, the turf interaction they get. So I couldn't imagine that he was changing lofts when he was going in and out of these different sets and messing around with loft packages. But that's probably one of the reasons he's been able to so seamlessly get back and forth between them. When do we find a point of stability here?
I mean, I think now. So here's something interesting. Daryl Survey, who is the company that goes out every week on the PGA Tour, and you know, when you see an advertisement that says number one golf ball, number one driver on the PGA Tour, there is somebody, usually a couple of people, that are out there on the practice green on Thursday when players start teeing off, and they check everything in the bag. And they go through, and that's how they do the Daryl survey counts, to make sure that these manufacturers know where they stand if they're, you know, the most played iron or wedge on tour. So here's something interesting, though, Tim, that I just found out. So Victor Hovland, via Daryl, was listed as playing a split set of irons, a split set that included I-210, long 4-6, and mid and short irons with the I-blade. Now that wasn't too uncommon, because he had actually played the reverse of that set at the US Open when he first changed the ping equipment. But Kenton actually told me that it was a full set of eye blades. It was not a split set, which, you know, again, it's different. It's still the fourth different combination that he's used, but it seems like maybe Victor's getting a bit closer to something that he likes. He clearly likes that eye blade. He's used it in other combo sets, and now he's using a full set. I think we're getting pretty close to maybe, dare I say, Victor Hovland finding a match. So we'll see what happens. But this may be it for him. It may be I-blade.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue into the last point of conversation regarding tour news. And that is, we are now at the end of the official season with the tour championship last week. So, you know, some folks continue to do their equipment tinkering in the wintertime. Some folks start it now. So, you know, as far as where Victor's concerned, I would agree with you. We're going to start seeing some stability in his set as he enters in the official new playing year for the PGA Tour. But I think it's worth discussing for our listeners out there regarding how this has kind of evolved with the wraparound season and what effect that's had over gear and gear testing.
Some players that I've talked to, Tim, have actually said they've had to alter their schedule because of the new wraparound season. There's very few weeks in between the end of the Tour Championship and the beginning of the 2019-2020 season. So, you know, players have said that their testing window has been altered. They might do a little bit of testing during that window, but a lot of them, for the most part, are still testing late in the year. You know, I would say 75 to 80% of tour players, maybe even more than that, live in Arizona, California, Florida, warm climates where you can play golf year round. So they don't really have to worry about weather affecting when they test. But it is interesting to see how the wraparound has altered. Maybe they would normally test everything late in the year, and now they might start testing wedges kind of during that brief window before the first event of the new season. So yeah, you know, it's one of those things that tour players just kind of have to adjust to. You know, they've now done enough wraparound seasons where I think most guys are pretty comfortable with their testing schedules. But, you know, again, always trying to bring this back to the recreational golfer. You know, for you, I'm curious, Tim, how do you test when it comes to new equipment? Are you the kind of guy that likes to test just kind of as you feel the need to, or do you typically like to go throughout the bag and try and see if you can find a bunch of things that you might want to change in and out?
Me personally, I, interestingly enough, I'm not much of a tinkerer. When I find something that works, I like to stick to
it. I can't believe that. I don't believe this, right? Yeah, with all the gear you have around you, there's a lot of temptation there, Tim.
My office is my office. We should take some pictures and put it on social. I've got a lot of cool toys in my office that I get sent to me by shaft reps, etc. A lot of prototype stuff that you know, a lot of our listeners would probably ooh and ah over. You know, I always am testing new product, not necessarily for it going in my own bag, but more so to understand product, you know, features, benefits, performance profiles, and how it relates to our customers at TruSpec and how that's going to play into the way that we fit golf clubs. So it's very regular that I'm testing all of the new stuff and looking at it and messing around with it. As far as personal changes, if I find something that works, I don't switch it very often. That being said, I don't play golf very frequently anymore, so I think that I'm always tinkering these days just because I'm unhappy with the fact that I'm not very good at golf, or at least as good as I used to be. So from that regard, you know, I'm always open to a new free agent to join the team, so to speak. But when I do find something that I like that works, I tend to keep it in there a little while. You know, how that applies out on tour, keep in mind that your most elite players are signing contracts that mandate that they update every year. You know, some of the guys that don't sign those contracts and stay brand agnostic, that gives them flexibility. I know that I think we shared a story about working with a player that had a circa 2007 driver that happened to be, you know, a really outstanding product. And we must have worked for 7 hours trying to find different iterations of shafts, heads, specs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the day, what he had in the bag ended up being the best thing that we tested, even compared to all the updated product. And then that being said, the next player that you work with will walk in with something that's 7 years old, he loves it, and then the very first option you try, you know, knocks it out of the water. So the only real way to go through this is to get your hands on it and be able to test it in an objective format. I think what's advisable to any recreational golfer out there would be have an honest assessment over your current golf game. Are you a good driver of the golf ball? Are you a good iron player? Are you a good putter? What's the part of your game that probably needs the most work? That's where I would focus in first. Obviously, maybe the gear is playing into why you have deficiencies in that category of club. See a PGA professional, see a professional club fitter, come to a TruSpec location. Make sure that it's done brand agnostically. That's another thing that I would advise. You know, obviously, I know we all have our preferences for brands and we all have affinities to companies. But as far as the scorecard, the scorecard does not. The scorecard only knows what clubs are going to work. So take a brand agnostic approach. Obviously, having some data available to you using launch monitors That's going to help determine, you know, what ends up being in the ballpark. And if you have, you know, two products that the numbers are pretty similar, then you can go to the more subjective things like look and feel. But make it data-driven, make it objective, make it brand agnostic. That would be my advice. Focus on the parts of the game, the categories of your clubs that tend to give you the most problems. Have an open mind. I can't express that enough. Have an open mind. There are so many folks out there that have preferences and biases towards certain design characteristics of clubs, when in fact, they don't really know why they have those biases. And those biases undermine what they actually need to play their best. So having an open mind is very important. And then once you dial in a couple of products that, you know, kind of perform well and make sense, get it out on the golf course. You know, make sure that you test it out there and see what it does for you when the pressure's on. If you go about it from that perspective, you know, I think that the average retail golfer is going to find golf clubs that stay in their bag a lot longer. And, you know, we spoke to Abraham in our interview about him having, you know, 14 clubs in his bag that he loves. There's no secret that this is his best year that he's ever played. So I think that that's part of the puzzle, is having confidence in every single piece of equipment in your bag.
And I have deficiencies in every area of my game, so maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise that I literally have about a million golf clubs that I test everything all at once. It's truly a sight to behold. I should probably start doing that behind some trees or something so that the public can't watch me as I hack away. But yeah, that's a lot of really good advice right there, Tim. The next thing I want to get into is an email that I received here recently. Got an email from Nissan, and I had to do a double take because they have a new product out that I'm pretty sure you and I, if given the opportunity, we would pay an obscene amount of money for this product. So Nissan has a new self-driving car out called the ProPilot 2.0. And this car has a system, obviously, where you don't have to put your hands on the wheel and it'll drive itself. I don't know if you could pay me enough money to sit in a car that could drive itself. I am kind of a control freak. I don't think I could relinquish that kind of control. But they use this self-driving technology to create a golf ball with a similar system. So this new golf ball, it's called the ProPilot golf ball. I don't think it's coming to retail. At least I hope it's not, because it could be a slow play nightmare. And here's why. So the golf ball has a motor inside the ball. And the setup requires external cameras linked to software that locates the cup and the ball. And from there, there's an algorithm that controls the internal motor in the ball. And based on how the ball is struck at impact, that golf ball is going to find the hole 10 times out of 10. That's a golfer's dream. It brings me back. Oh yeah, sign me up. It brings me back, Tim, to that scene from Caddyshack, where Rodney Dangerfield's character, Al Cervic, is there on the green, and he's got some sort of an odd device in his hands that's attached to a putter. And he said, got this from Albert Einstein. Nice man. Made a fortune in physics. And he wraps about a 20-footer and buries it. And I thought, man, what would it be like to have a putter that could do that? Well, now Nissan is creating a golf ball. Which brings me to this. This golf ball is highly illegal. Regardless, I'm still taking it for a spin if given the chance. Tim, are you in?
Heck yeah. I want to make sure I have a nice little wager before I hit a putt with it going. And obviously,
there's going to be a lot of tech around the green, though. There's going to be a lot of technology around the green. You'd have to conceal that behind some bushes or something so that you're so that the guy that you're going to be making that wager with doesn't get to see all the tech involved with getting this golf ball in the hole.
Yeah, I mean, it's opening Pandora's box, so to speak, when you're talking about high-tech involvement in golf. You know, I think a lot of golfers are going to be very excited at some of the things on the horizon that are going to transform the game, both as far as equipment and just the overall experience. This being, you know, one of them. I know that Encore is a ball brand that has a patent on what's called a genius ball, and that's where they've chipped the golf ball. So instead of needing launch monitors, you've got a little chip inside the ball that will be able to tell you spin rates and ball velocity and things like that. It's kind of just a concept right now that they've patented. and it's not been commercialized yet, but really cool idea, really cool product. I know back in my R&D days, going back, gosh, I feel so old saying this, but going back 20 years.
You're going to date yourself.
I know. Going back 20 years to my time working on the R&D team with Strata, Spalding, and Ben Hogan Companies, we were working on a self-correcting golf ball. And the Polaris that exists these days is kind of a derivative of that. Yeah, and the idea there was to move the CG, or center of gravity, or center of mass of the ball, off-center from the core so that the ball was actually, you know, asymmetrical, so to speak, from its construction standpoint on the interior. And the idea being that it would slow down the spin rate of the ball, and if the ball is not spinning as much, it can't curve. I remember doing testing on that on the swing robots, setting up, you know, these crazy pathway and face angles that were designed to make the ball slice and hook. And these balls didn't go very far, but they kind of wobbled through the air, but they didn't curve. They went straight. They kind of self-corrected. So you're going to see a lot of technologies out in the marketplace in the next 10 to 15 years that are really, really cool technologies designed to enhance the experience. Goes back to one stance I have on equipment in general. The game is so difficult. You look at the rules of equipment for amateur and professional athletes in other sports, whether it's baseball or some of the other games that are played, and they do have a different equipment rule book. Why not golf? Let's make it easy for folks. Let's allow them to have some more fun out there.
You're here.
So let's get that Nissan Pro Pilot golf ball in play. I want one.
I'm totally buying one if they come out with it. Although I don't know if I want to see the price tag for something that has a small motor inside. All right. Podcast questions for this week. Got a couple of good ones as usual. First one up, from Brian Gamberini. And he asks, I have had the same set of irons since high school. Tommy Armour 845s, great irons, classic irons. Love those. He got him 17 years ago. He's a 7.5 handicapper and he's ready to get something new. He's got two young girls, so he doesn't play that often. Hey, this sounds like me. How do I start my search?
Wow. A lot on that one right there. So first and foremost,
this is bringing me back to my high school days.
I had that set of irons. That was what I played all through junior golf, actually into my freshman year of college. Loved the 845 nice. Series.
Yeah, they were great irons.
Great set of irons. You know, it was interesting. Those first 845s were kind of playing off of the unilength idea. A lot of people don't know that, but the specs on those 845 irons were very different than most iron specs in that the increments of length change from one to the next were not your typical half-inch increments. Once again, I'm dating myself here that I know that much about 845. I love
those irons. I still remember the 845, so I'm in the same boat as you, Tim.
But, you know, that just looking at that golf club from a profile, it had a good bit of offset. There was definitely a lot of offset, especially in those longer irons. There was a lot of offset in those clubs. They kind of had a more angular profile with a more angular toe than a rounded toe. So I would tend to gravitate towards clubs that had a little bit more offset. I think that that's going to be more familiar. In this case, you know, for the player being that's something that they've looked down at and been comfortable with in the past, something that has a little bit more angular profile. You look at Titleist, you know, they have a little bit more angular toe section than some of the brands that are out there. Mira has a little bit more angular toe section than some of the brands that are out there. So I would pick something that has a general shaping that's similar. One thing's for sure. Iron technology has come light years since 845s. So if we were to put an 845 in a player test against pretty much anything else that's out there today, anything that's current would smoke it. So suffice to say that whatever you end up going with, it's probably going to outperform, you know, those Tommy Armour 845s significantly. But I would definitely go towards something aesthetically that looked similar, at least to begin with. And then what I would probably focus on is, okay, definitely going to need some perimeter weighting, so stay away from the stuff that lacks perimeter weighting. Definitely going to probably need technologies in there like variable face thickness, which expand the sweet spot. Anybody that's been away from the game for a long time, there's going to be, you know, it's not like riding a bike. You're going to have to spend some time getting reacclimated to making solid contact. And then the other part of this would be, you know, is this a fast club head speed swinger or a slow club head speed swinger? And that's going to depend upon the shaft makeup that you end up putting in there, which also plays into trajectory profiles. So do you end up going with a product that's designed to flight a little lower or hit it a little higher? That's all, you know, depending upon what that player tends to get out of golf clubs. The only way to find that out is by trying a few different products. So that's kind of where I would start. Look for something that has a similar aesthetic, a similar shaping to it, and then make sure that it's something that's more in the game improvement end, that has some perimeter weighting and some other technology to help enhance ball speed on off-center hits. And then you're going to have to start looking at, okay, based upon the feedback of a professional, am I hitting this too high, hitting it too low, and how can I change that?
Normally, I don't like to tell people to change irons, even if they've got a set that's 8 to 10 years old, because, you know, everybody, once you find something you really like, it's tough to change a set of irons. But when you're going on a set that hasn't been changed in 17 years, yeah, I agree. It's time to try out some new tech. There's so many good things out there at the moment. I'm sure you can find an iron that can beat your old 845s, at least in the performance section. I don't know about looks and feel. Those, again, were great irons. All right, next question. How does a player figure out whether a combo set is for them when a typical iron fitting is only hitting either a 6 or a 7 iron?
Wow, so this is a complicated question to answer. You know, ultimately, I think it comes down to strike patterns, looking at the concentration of the strike pattern when you're talking about where you're hitting it on the face and how consistently you're hitting it on the face, seeing how that evolves when you go from a 9 iron to a 6 iron to a 4 iron, if you do carry a 4 iron. And that you can tell based upon your own set. So the set that you currently are playing, take a look at that, you know, deviation or the amount of change you're getting as far as impact location. If the impact location starts to expand significantly and you're less consistent in those longer clubs, you definitely need something that's going to have a little bit more perimeter weighting. As to how to apply this into a fitting when you're only necessarily hitting a 6 iron, I mean, a true spec, we fit with 6 irons. It definitely is a complicated question to answer as far as how you determine what that demarcation iron is. And what I mean by that is, okay, maybe I'm playing a muscle back blade in my scoring irons, and then I'm playing a, you know, forged cavity back muscle cavity in the mid irons, and then I go to a full-on game improvement in the long irons. How do I know what iron I need to depart from? I would say this, one of the pivotal irons in any set is an 8 iron. 8 iron is usually the one that pros look, you know, when they're looking at sets of clubs for the first time, one of the first irons they pick up usually is the 8 iron. And looking at how the set is blending from the scoring irons into the mid irons. And that 8 iron is kind of that departure club where it starts to transition. So if you're looking at a combo set, I definitely would consider wedge 9 and 8 all kind of being the same. And then you can consider to jump off into a 7 iron, 6 iron, 5 iron. That would have a little bit more perimeter weighting with a little bit more offset in it potentially as well. If you don't like looking at offset in the 7 iron, then you know maybe you want to consider the 7 iron that's matching the wedge 9 and 8. By the time a player gets into the 6 iron, most amateur golfers these days do need a little bit of forgiveness when they get to a 6 iron. Keep in mind that a lot of the lofts on these 6 iron these days are more parallel to what the lofts of 5 irons in years past were. So, you know, when you look at old school 5 irons, that's when we started to see performance really start to take a hit with golfers, is when they get into that 28 degree loft range. The other thing that I think is very important to consider with combo sets is the loft packages. You know, as we stated earlier, standard is not standard. When you look at brands and different product lines, there are different loft packages throughout. And so if you end up deciding that you want to make a combo set where you have 8 degrees of difference, you know, if you were to try to put a set of Tiger Woods blades in play up to the 7 iron, and then you were to put a set of 790s in play from the 6 iron, you know, they're on top, you're going to end up with a huge loft differential going from that departure point of the blade to the 790 iron. So in that case, you're going to end up with a huge gap. So if you are going to combo your set, understanding the way that the lofts are set up, I think, is important. Understanding what technologies are being included in those long irons, if there are distance technologies. The last thing you want to end up with is a 20 or 25 yard gap between your 6 iron and your 7 iron. I've had it happen with players that built combo sets where they actually had 2 6 irons in the bag. That's kind of unique. What was the reason? Well, the reason was going from the 6 iron to the 5 iron, there was a huge, huge gap. So we ended up doing 2 6 irons. 1 6 iron matched, you know, the scoring irons, and then the other 6 iron matched the 5 iron and 4 iron. And they ended up having a setup that, you know, had sequential gapping throughout. So gapping is a very important thing. Distance gapping is a very important thing to consider when you're making a decision about combo sets. And then just the overall proficiency with, you know, needing perimeter weighting or any of these game improvement technologies.
Love it. All right. With that, let's get to this week's interview. Tim and I had the opportunity to talk gear with 2018 Australian Open winner Abraham Anser. He's coming off the best season of his career on the PGA Tour and was recently named to the international team for the President's Cup. Here's part one of our chat where we discussed his unique Mirror deal and club experiences growing up in Mexico. Well, we're pleased to be welcomed by a guy who I'd consider to be a certified gearhead. He's coming off the best season of his PGA Tour career and is bound for Australia for the President's Cup as a member of the international team later this year. 2018 Australian Open winner Abraham Anser. Abraham, thanks for hopping on the Fully Equipped podcast.
How's it going, guys? Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, Abraham, it's great to have you on. Really great to see you play so well to close out the year, and thanks so much for joining us here on Fully Equipped. You know, I'm curious, you've been a professional golfer now for 6 years, so that's definitely getting some time behind you in learning the ropes. I'd be curious what you've learned about your equipment since you turned pro, as far as your general knowledge base regarding equipment and how that differs from your amateur and collegiate career.
Yeah, well, in college, I played all Nike stuff. OU was a Nike elite school, so it was just pretty easy to just fall into that path. And I mean, I like their equipment. And then I signed with them right out of college, so I played all Nike equipment up until on my first year on the PGA Tour, and I wasn't really that much into knowing a lot about equipment back then, but once they stopped making equipment, I had to kind of think about what path I wanted to go and what I want to do. And I just said, you know what, I'm just going to play the best equipment for me or what I prefer to play. Even though if I don't get a deal or anything, it doesn't matter. I'll just try to make my money on the golf course. And that's when I fell into, I mean, Mira. I always knew Mira was such a good, just quality of forging irons and just the quality control they have was, I mean, it was incredible. One of my good buddies here in San Antonio is a club fitter, and he distributes Mira, and I started messing around with him. Although at that time, I was also trying other equipment, and I couldn't really. It was a very easy decision for me to go with Mira, just by even weighting the heads and just comparing what they're supposed to be on like paper. And once you get the actual heads, I mean, Mira was always spot on. It was incredible. And other brands were just, sometimes they were a little bit off, sometimes they were quite a bit off. So that's what I knew. I was like, okay, I'm definitely going to play Mira irons.
Understood. And so you would say that, you know, your exposure to gear and high-level club fitting, that kind of started as you filtered onto the PGA Tour, or was that something you did throughout your college career as well at Oklahoma and prior to that at Odessa?
I think it all started when Nike stopped making equipments, and I had to really think about what kind of path I wanted to go and what clubs I wanted to use. And yeah, that's when I really started learning a lot more about equipment and how everything worked. And I was like, man, I had no idea about all this stuff. And in college, I just really didn't know much about it. And I just kind of played with whatever people told me of whatever the numbers were supposed to be and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I mean, sometimes they were good, but I could have done a lot better if I would have known all this stuff that I know now.
Abraham, the deal you inked with Mira was, in my opinion, far from conventional. I believe you're a full partner in Mira's Mexico distribution rights. Was that the kind of deal you were looking to sign after your Nike contract ended? And how did that whole deal come about?
Yeah, I think it's a very unique deal for sure. And no, I never really thought about it whenever Nike was done making clubs. Always, like I said, I was really been a big fan of Mira. And then I was already playing their irons for at least a year and a half without having a deal or anything. I was either, I mean, either way, I was already playing the irons. Just in talks with all the Mura guys. They've never really sponsored a player on any tour, so it was definitely a first for them, a first for ours, and it just made sense. I think it's a win-win for all parties, giving us the distribution rights for Mura in Mexico. And I mean, they really, Mexico is a pretty untapped market for Mura, which it was good for Mura itself, so they could get a little bit bigger and a little more exposure in Mexico. It's a win for us and for me to kind of get the brand out there as well, and us being the only guys that can sell Mura over there. And yeah, I mean, there's some big plans ahead, which we're really excited about.
That's all great stuff, Abraham. You know, when you change gear, especially at the professional level, it can be both exciting and a little bit nerve-wracking. Obviously, when you start to trust your gear and you've played with it for a period of time, and then with the departure of Nike from the golf industry, where you had to change a lot of your gear, I'd be curious to understand, when you're looking at new equipment, what's the most important consideration you make? Are you more of an aesthetics and feel guy? Are you more of a numbers guy? Are you looking for equipment that's going to allow you to flight the ball and spin it differently and shape shots differently? Are you looking for forgiveness or consistency? If you can get a little bit into that, I think our listeners would really get something out of that.
Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, that's why I say I'm not going to just sign with a company that's going to make me play all 14 clubs and the ball and that I've never used before. I just say, you know what, I'm gonna play whatever I know I can play good with, and if I can get a deal out of that, good. If not, I'll just make my money on the golf course. Because going into a process of just changing everything, changing irons, drivers, and golf ball, I mean, it's pretty nerve-wracking, because you don't know what's going to happen. It could work, or it can take a long time for you to get used to that feel of the ball flight. I mean, everything changes. Like I said, I just went with, I did a lot of testing with balls and irons and drivers, and just found what worked for me, and I knew that was going to work. I got ready in the off season, and I just told my agent, hey, this is what I'm going to go with. If we can get something going, great, because this is the brands that I feel really comfortable with. And yeah, we got some deals. Well, we didn't. I mean, it was fine. I don't regret anything at all. I think it's worked really well, and I'm happy I made that decision. But for me, yes, I have to know that the numbers are right. I look at spin rates with my iron, especially. I got to be, because I got in trouble, my first year in as a pro. I guess some rep just kind of was pushing. I wasn't hitting it that well. He's like, hey, you got to try these shafts. And at the time, I didn't know. And I was like, okay, cool. And then you get excited. You got something new. You hit it. You're like, you kind of flush a couple shots. Like, okay, these are perfect. But then you play three weeks in a row. You're not swinging as fast as you were. And then those balls are not staying in the air. And I mean, I played some shots that I was not. I mean, they were good shots, but the ball wasn't staying in the air. I mean, the spin rates weren't right. And I definitely struggled. So learn from that. And yeah, whenever I try something new, If it doesn't work in the first 3-4 shots, then I'm not gonna keep hitting it, because I'm gonna start manipulating my swing so I can hit that shot like I want to.
Abraham, you mentioned that you want to play equipment that you're comfortable with. I know you have artisan wedges in the bag, and you worked with Mike Taylor when you were at Nike. You could have put any wedges in there after your deal expired. I'm curious why you chose artisan. And what kind of a grind do you prefer on each one of your wedges?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very common question. I worked since I was in college with Mike Taylor. He's amazing at what he does. They really do a phenomenal job. I was really excited when they announced that they're going to keep doing wedges. Because after Nike was done, I dabbled into other companies and tried their stuff, which they were obviously... they were still very, very good, but it wasn't the stuff that I was really, really accustomed to when I played Nike wedges. And so, yeah, I went down there to, what was it? It was the week of the Colonial. I went and see some like Taylor. We talked about what I used in college. He remembered exactly kind of what I used. We didn't really tweak that much. I think we just added a little bit of a bevel in front of the on the leading edge, just to make the wedges a little more versatile whenever we go into places where it's soft and grainy. That way it wouldn't just catch that grass real quick and be easier to chunk. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know what to call the grind. I guess it's just my special sauce that we over the years, me and Mike Taylor kind of went with and know that that's a grind that works for me. I mean, it probably won't work for everybody, but I mean, everybody's got a little bit different motion and somebody uses bounce more than other people. I think my wedges have like 2 point something of bounce, so it's very, very minimal. They sit really, really, really low to the ground. I can really open that face, and I mean, it's just beautiful. And it's just what I've kind of felt really comfortable with. Even though, like I said, since we go with very, very little bounce, we have to use a little bit of that bevel for whenever I need to play in like soft conditions, because it will be pretty tough if without that bevel to hit it crisp whenever it's into the grain or the ground is really, really soft. But the grind doesn't have a name. It's just what we came up with through the years, really.
It's the Abraham grind. I mean, that's what we just got to name it that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious also, do you ever alter your wedge setup, or particularly the loft, based on the golf course you're playing? And when you and Mike were working on wedges, is there a certain shot that you need to see when you're testing a wedge that lets you know if you're on the right track?
Yeah, I mean, I always, when we go out and test and we have some new product, it's really important for the ball to not roll up the face. Because if I feel like I'm making a good, solid swing or like a little chip shot and the ball is just rolling up the face, I know either the loft and lie is just off or the grind is just not helping me with that shot. But like I said, yeah, we've done a lot of testing to get that special grind for me to work perfectly. And yeah, I mean, it's just, I love hitting or having in the bag that low spinning shot. And if I know I can pull that off out of pretty much any type of grass, I know I have the perfect recipe of loft and lie and grind and all that stuff. But yeah, we do quite a bit of testing to get to where we're at now.
And that'll do it for this week's episode of Fully Equipped. Special thanks to Abraham for joining us on this week's episode. We're off for Labor Day, but we'll be back the following week with all the latest gear news. Thanks for listening. We'll see you.